edge boundary cooperation agreements or different kinds of alliances. Success was making the central institutions a little bit more like one big unit where there used to be, well, 15 and then 25 and then 27 smaller units, making them look that way. And I think the evidence in support of this is actually comes from some of the great proponents of European Monetary Union at the time. So you get something like Jacques Santer, who was, of course, EU Commission President at the time, who wrote, the euro will bring citizens closer together, and will provide a physical manifestation of the growing rapprochement between European citizens, which has been taking place for the past 40 years or more. Now, there could have been a different, he could have said something different. He could have said, we need to bring citizens closer together, so let's triple the funding for Interreg. Let's make some of the possibilities of overcoming the rigidities of the old state system stronger so that we can actually create something that's less top-down and maybe more bottom-up that feeds into a sense that a boundary doesn't make quite the sense that it did historically. But that's not the argument that was made. It was, we're going to make more Europeans feel European. We need to create this institution which is about as state-like a step as you could possibly take. Or Wim Duisenberg, the president of the European Central Bank, touting the euro a few years earlier than the statement by Santer as the symbol of the future integration of 30 million people. And you can see the quote, that will change the way in which we think about one another as Europeans. And I could, I've got other quotes that I could go along this line. But it seems to me that these kinds of statements are indicative of a meta-geographical posture that assumes that effective state building will produce an identity community that is concomitant with the state. The assumption, in other words, is that states will gradually create a civic, if not a cultural nation, out of its disparate inhabitants if you just create something that looks a lot more like a state. And what's interesting is how often analogies were made to the early U.S. history after, you know, after the Revolutionary War. And of course, the U.S. colonies were quite divergent. Ultimately, a civil war was fought among them. There were very different interests. They did not feel themselves necessarily to be one nation. So the arguments made, well, it took the U.S. a few decades to do this, so give it time. This, the same thing will happen in Europe. But of course, to analogize between the Europe of the late 18th and early 19th centuries and the U.S. of the late 18th and early 19th centuries and the Europe of the present is to assume that there's not much difference in the kinds of identity communities that exist in the current Europe and the U.S. of 200 years ago. And I think if we're students of political geography and we're concerned about the relationship between identity and the political organization of space, that's a fairly problematic assumption, right? There was nothing really quite equivalent to I am French, I am German, I am Danish, what have you, in the context of the early U.S., which makes it a rather problematic kind of analog for what was going on here. Nonetheless, it was a pervasive, it still is a pervasive analog. I picked up something just the other day that was sort of describing things much in this way. And as students ourselves of the relationship between politics and culture, we, it seems to me, ought to be at the forefront of at least raising some questions about whether that's a useful analog to make or not. All right, so that's my sort of first, the first and most major argument to make in the paper. But the other thing I want to focus on is how, now that things have come apart a little bit, how the whole crisis is being framed and what this means for how we think about Europe and what might happen to Europe in the future. First of all, it's important to recognize that even though monetary union got off to a somewhat rocky start, that with few exceptions, the actual mechanics of introducing the euro went remarkably smoothly. I mean, there were those who claimed that it was an excuse for raising prices and so forth, but the mechanics went fairly smoothly. And at least for a while, the asymmetric shocks were not so great as to expose major problems during the middle years of the past decade. However, despite that, the evidence suggests that the introduction of the euro, even before the current sovereign debt crisis, did not produce a significant uptick in feelings of national attachment among European Union members. Now this, I apologize, this violates all rules of overheads, and I use it only to convey, I will tell you the important things, but it was actually a study that I found just before I finished this paper, so I didn't have time to really render it properly. But it's by a geographer that some of you may know, Anton Zisch, and it was a study of these answers to national identity questions that occurred during these polls during the early 2000s. And the point of it is not the numbers, but the result is we don't see the euro being followed by an uptick in national identity. And in fact, individual country studies of all sorts confirm this. A study of even in a place like Austria that was done by Meyer Pesty and Kirchler that shows that in Austria there was no significant uptick in European identity in the wake of EMU. There has been one study by McLaren that raised some questions about whether there might have actually been we might be asking the wrong question. She was suggesting, because people actually really based their judgment of EMU not on nationalist versus non-nationalist lines, but just on utilitarian lines. But I think even there you could raise some questions, because a lot of the utilitarian things she was focusing on are things provided by governments, and so there's a question of exactly what the mix is there of nationalism versus utilitarian concerns. But it seems to me that at least from the polls that were evident at the time, there's a reason to suggest that, at least in the first few years, during the calm times, there was not much indication that EMU was being followed by a sort of strong uptick in European identity segments. And in fact, even right before the current debt crisis, The Economist had an interesting piece entitled, I think, Why the Dutch Fell Out of Love with Europe. So this is before the current crisis, saying that the feeling has grown that the EU and its treaties are elite projects that may please self-serving bureaucrats but are remote from the concerns of ordinary citizens. So that idea was very much there even before the current sovereign debt crisis, but after the adoption of the euro. So along comes the euro, and I certainly don't need to say anything to this audience about some of the general reactions that have unfolded. But I think it's almost something I could state without much evidence that it has, if anything, undermined feelings of Europeanness within Europe. In fact, it has in some ways exposed the depth of nationalist as opposed to European sentiment in the EU. This is a piece from Acta Politica in 2007, The Evolution of Net Support for European Integration. This is only carried through 2004, but if you look at kind of the general trend lines, it's actually not terribly encouraging from the onset of the idea of EMU right on down through the early 2000s. It certainly has worked against support for adopting the EU in non-Eurozone countries. So a survey undertaken by Czech Republic Today, which is a newspaper in Czechia, in the spring 2012, showed that some 76% of Czechs now are against the adoption of the euro. And just 9 months earlier, it was 68%. And just 9 months before that, it was in the 50s. You see the trend. Or in Poland, a Polish newspaper also this spring did a survey finding some 64% of Poles now against the adoption of the euro, against, again, higher than before. So it raises some questions now about what's happening now and how the crisis now plays into dominant ontologies of political space that are out there. And I think the interesting and somewhat concerning thing to watch as this is all unfolded is, first of all, that it has solidified the view that the fundamental political geographic issue for Europe is whether powers should be centralized at one institution at the center or left at the states. In other words, it's framed the problem not in terms of transboundary alliances or different kinds of exchange networks or different kinds of relational kinds of approaches that we as political geographers are quite interested in. It's framed the problem in terms of big state or 27 individual states. Indeed, there's been a storm of critique focused on the comparative advantages of state versus EU control over policy sectors. And one of the interesting things is how prominent a role now in the whole discussion of how we deal with the crisis is being played not by the central institutions of the European Union, but by state political leaders. I mean, the folks in the driver's seat are Angela Merkel and now Hollande in France and so forth. So that seems to me to see one fairly uncontrovertible impact of all this. A second is that it has really highlighted the divergent positions and interests of individual EU countries. And I come back to this rather amusing graphic that I used at the beginning. Because I cannot remember a time in recent, over the last couple, three decades, where I've heard more about the individual differences of European countries. Obviously, with the Greeks and the Germans kind of at the forefront of all this. And again, I could go into more detail, and we can during the question and answer period, but I want to keep this within a reasonable amount of time so we have chance for the Q&A. But I, you know, in the paper, I cite some, well, headlines and examples like Greece is burning and Germany is stoking the flames, and you get all sorts of somewhat sensationalist rhetoric about that, all focused on those older units, the individual states and their perspectives on this. Then also, what seems to me in case nothing I said was of interest, I had to throw up on the screen a couple of these amusing maps produced by a Bulgarian artist, a modern Bulgarian artist, Svetkov. And I don't know if any of you have seen these, and I've actually got one from the perspective of Germany at the end if we want to put it up, but he's done these quite amusing maps that have showed, you know, the Europe according to, and then, you know, how the Greeks see it and so forth. But these things are getting a lot of circulation. Here's the one for, you know, for the French. So anyway, I figured this would be the right place in the lecture to provide a little bit of comic relief. I promised to stay to 35 minutes, and I'm at 30, so I will just talk for no more than 5 minutes, and then I will we'll stop. Oh, sorry. I have my watch up here. So what, of course, the consequence of all this is that a more nuanced, less country-specific analysis is drowned out. You know, this is now a graph you sometimes see. It's interest rates on 10-year government bonds from Greece, and you can see the pattern. What's interesting is you can interpret this all as Greece mismanages its money with no significant attention to what being a part of the euro meant for what Greece could do and how investment in Greece might be seen or gave cover to a Goldman Sachs to come in and push various kinds of financial instruments with kind of consequences to this, all gets hidden in a public popular discourse of what the Greeks are like and how they have been improper stewards of their economy and society. So what has happened is that we have marginalized, in a sense, the representations of Europe that depart from the modernist political territorial norms as a part of the process of all this reaction to the crisis. So, you know, of these, again, just maps to evoke other ways of thinking about Europe. I mean, like the Diaz and Lord map that was kind of an interesting, you know, more networked way of thinking about Europe, are kind of lost in the process. Or the kind of innovative characteristics that come from now new programs like ESPON, the European Spatial Planning Observation Network, or CORIN, or some of these new ways of envisioning what space is like and how different spaces are related together gets pushed to the side. The idea of a maze Europe or a post-national polity gets kind of lost in the face of this tendency now to re-emphasize states and state interests. And just for fun, I plugged into Google search the words European unity a couple of months ago. And you know, the first couple of pages of images, for every one image of unity, there's another cartoon like a couple of the ones that I've shown you, or flags flying in different directions, or what have you. So it again kind of shows you how the sort of popular ways in which this is being presented and presumably consumed, if anything, just reinforce the older modernist territorial norms rather than the kinds of things that geographers and others have been writing about it. And of course, you also see then, just in terms of things going on here on the ground, some indications of some erosion in the sense of Europeanness, like the decline in participation in European Parliament elections and so forth. To summarize and conclude then, it seems to me that the emphasis on interstate differences and a concomitant de-emphasis on extra-strait arrangements and networks has produced precisely the opposite state of affairs from that foreseen by many of the EMU's greatest proponents that I had up there on the screen a few minutes ago. So we're, of course, at a difficult moment. And to step back and do this kind of academic exercise and, well, how did we get here and what were the assumptions and what are the consequences might seem a bit of irrelevant where folks are concerned about the tires coming off the truck. And clearly, there's a pressing need to chart a path that helps avert a major financial collapse and that preserves much of the good that has come out of Europe's unprecedented experiment with integration. But it does seem to me that this larger effort to engage how we got here and how it's being framed has some implications for how we think about what's going forward. The principal proposals now for how to deal with what's happened are yet more centralization. And it may well be that this is what's needed, and I really don't feel qualified to say that's what should be taken, the step that should be taken or not. But it seems to me, at least, what is also needed is not just a renewed focus on centralization, but also a renewed focus on functional arrangements, networks, and relationships that transcend the spatial logic of the modern state system, so we're not just continually reinforcing that logic. The need for a reevaluation, more generally, of how success for European integration is envisioned, as something more than just sort of the centralization of powers, but maybe measured more by the deployment of novel types of political space that could be brought into being by the European Union, spaces that make people construct notions of us and them in less state territorial terms. And finally, beyond Europe, with various other parts of the world considering various kinds of superstrate integration initiatives, it seems to me that the lesson here is that meta-geographical understandings matter and that those need to be taken into consideration carefully as one tries to design the nature of the institutions and processes that are going to bring those kinds of supranational arrangements into the 21st century. So there you have it. Thank you very much for your attention. And I believe now it's time to turn things over to the formal discussants.
Thank you, Alec, for such a provoking and thought-inspiring lecture. And thanks for providing your paper so timely to give me the opportunity to react with what I hope is a substantial and substantive comment. I think your intervention really comes at a critical juncture when the EU is arguably at a watershed. You had United We Stand, Divided We Fall up there. I think from a lot of people at the moment, it's the opposite. Divided we stand and united we fall. The spring 2012 wave of the Pew Global Attitudes Project shows that in most European nations, public opinion has swung against EU membership, which you can see here. So from 2009, which was after the onset of the financial crisis, to 2012 in the midst of the sovereign debt crisis, we have a significant reduction of support for the question membership in the EU is a good thing, yes or no. Only in Germany, it's been going up slightly. And at this time, one can understand is the EU feels the necessity to promote European unity. And they did so recently in February 2012 by releasing a video that was intended to promote the idea of European union among younger people. I'm not going to withhold it from you because it actually speaks to some of the ideas that Alec has brought up. Is there a sound with this laptop? Yes? Okay. So,
how have you seen that before? I'm curious, because I've seen it before.
Okay, not so many. Perhaps that's because, for quite obvious reasons, it had to be retracted a couple of days after it was released, due to also very, very obvious complaints. Obvious perhaps for you, but not for the people in the European Commission who approved its release. And interestingly, it hasn't gone viral on YouTube. It's still available on YouTube, but it only has 7,000 clicks, so it's not very popular. And I think its message is very much in tune with what Alec diagnoses in his paper, a view of the EU as a superstate, which is in competition with other states, and the drawing of clear boundaries, very racial boundaries here as well, who belongs there and who does not. This building of a superstate would mean reinforcing the neat scalar hierarchies of supranational, national, regional, local, and giving more power to the supranational at the expense of alternative metageographies of overlapping spatialities, such as those that Alec mentioned, transboundary networks or interregional cooperation arrangements, that would deserve the label of what John Ruggie about 20 years ago claimed might be, and I quote him, the first truly postmodern international political form. It's hard to disagree with Alec on normative grounds, because the vision that he sketches is indeed, I think, a very appealing one. But I would like to argue that we might present it with a somewhat different picture and different perspective if you look not only at the formal arrangements of European Monetary Union and the narratives on integration, but also at how these are practiced. I'm going to offer up very briefly three different perspectives in the following. One is what I call the EU as always local. Because if you look, I would argue, beyond the formal distribution of responsibilities, we might find that the scalar territorial logic is not quite as clear-cut as it might sometimes seem. Instead of viewing the EU as carved up in multiple levels, then, one could adopt an alternative perspective and perhaps ask how these levels are the product of a larger network, despite the formal subordination that may exist, or the formal distribution of responsibilities, or upwards distribution of responsibilities to a center in Brussels. And I'm taking a cue here from Bruno Latour, who suggests that all organizations, even those that look very large and complex, are after all continuously local. He says the following: if you wander about inside IBM, if you follow the chains of command of the Red Army, if you inquire in the corridors of the Ministry of Education, if you never leave the local level, could IBM be made up of a series of local interactions, the Red Army of an aggregate of conversations in the mess hall, the Ministry of Education of a mountain of pieces of paper? So instead of taking the EU as one big layered organization, a multi-level organization, one could ask how it is made up of multiple socio-material relations that need to be actualized again and again over and over for it to emerge as an actor, and how scales are enacted, or perhaps not enacted, in this process. So this is more of a different conceptual theoretical access that one could take. Next point on the overflowing geographies of the euro is perhaps a more empirical one, because the usage of the euro, I believe, is a case in point that illustrates how a product of the modern territorial system, as Alec has demonstrated, really overflows the hierarchical state space or supranational space that created and regulates it. And of particular interest here are those cases where the euro is used without official sanctioning of the European Central Bank, called Euroization. Kosovo and Montenegro, that's two states that Alex showed on his map, for example, used the euro as a de facto currency. In many other countries in Central and Eastern Europe, it functions as parallel currency to the local currencies, either in cash transactions or for assets and liabilities. So estimates, for example, put the amount of euro banknotes that's circulating outside the eurozone at 20 to 25% of the total, most of it in Central and Eastern Europe, which I believe is quite a significant amount. In 2006, for example, there was a survey in Croatia, and each resident of Croatia holds about 500 euros in cash, which is also a significant amount, perhaps more than I hold in cash. In countries like Croatia or Serbia, more than half of all loans are denominated in euros, with even higher shares in Latvia and Lithuania. So I brought this map, which shows the most recent data. So I guess what this might suggest then is that a significant part of the usage of the euro falls outside the area of jurisdiction of the European Central Bank, but also at the same time outside the reach of the monetary policies of the affected countries. In practice, overturning, I would argue, the rigid scalar hierarchies that the EMU mandates. And these unintended overflows, as Michel Collot would probably call them, frequently bypass official channels and bring into being informal networks, integrating individuals into the eurozone, where the respective countries here are often unlikely to join the EMU in the future or don't want to. And the effects of these overflows also tend to undermine state authority in many cases, often tied to informal economic activity that facilitate tax evasion and rent seeking, and often weaken government's capacity to engage in effective macroeconomic intervention. So while these overflows of the euro outside the territorial system of the EMU have had a significant impact, I would argue, on people's everyday lives in many neighboring countries, my last point is, somewhat provocatively, that this is much less the case with most cross-border initiatives in the EU, which tend to be rather toothless tigers. Alec Murphy gives a number of examples in his paper of a non-territorial metrogeographical imagination that's attached to those initiatives. The Formotus Agreement, for example, ESPON, the European Spatial Planning and Observation Network, CORIN, which is the coordination of information on the environment, the European Lawyers Association, ELA, and so on. And to be honest, I did have to look up some of those because I didn't know them or hadn't heard of them before. And even if I ask some of you, I think some of you might find some of those quite new to you. And I think the situation is going to be quite the same if you ask ordinary European citizens. So this is not to say that such initiatives are not important, but as long as they're not undergirded, I would argue, by the concomitant regulatory or prescriptive power, they run the danger of remaining toothless tigers. And one could argue for the current euro crisis, in fact, that its cause was too little, instead of perhaps too much power given to the EU. One of the central design flaws, at least according to economists, was that there was a lack in an ability to coordinate budgeting, taxes, healthcare, and labor policies. So a political union was lacking. Gaining such power, however, will require member states to cede it in the first place. And Alec is very skeptical whether giving more power to the EU will actually produce greater unity, and he's shown some evidence to that effect. I would venture the guess that it can, because it is likely, or at least that's my hope, to also create a greater shared sense of being affected by and responsible for the same policies. And it might help to institutionalize actually a very stronger sense of awareness that we're all sitting in the same boat, something that seems to be very much missing from many discussions on whether or not Greece should exit the euro area. And the cartoon actually spoke to this image. In a sense then, the current crisis, I believe, might be the best thing that ever happened to Europe. It can become a catalyst for close integration and in fact achieve something that, because of nationalist sentiments and particularist interests, our wildest dreams would not have allowed us to imagine just a few years ago. So in this sense, the European Monetary Union could be actually bring about greater political union, but not quite in the sense that it was initially envisioned in the original documents. Thanks a lot.